This panel began as a random idea that Sarasota, Florida, in 2006, had this very deeply broken race. And now that 5 years have passed almost, and there have been various academic projects that have looked at it, wouldn't it be fun to have some kind of a retrospective to see whether we can, see whether we've actually learned anything or not in the post facto Sarasota world? So, we've assembled a great panel today. We have two political scientists, a computer scientist, and a human factors person. Amazing. Because it's a multidisciplinary problem and it's going to be a multidisciplinary solution. So, leading off, Charles Stewart from MIT will be introducing what happened and will be giving his take on it. Then Walter Mebbin from Michigan will be giving us more stats and numbers and processing. Doug Jones from Iowa will talk about whether the touchscreen wasn't touchy enough. And Kristen Green from NIST, formerly Rice, will talk about some human subject experiments where they gave them simulated Sarasota ballots, so in lab conditions, see whether they could reproduce the problem. All right, Charles, take it away.
Thanks, Dan. So my job here is a bit to do more of the travelogue and just a little bit of my view on things. And just in the interest of full disclosure, to remind folks that Dan and I got involved in this in part because we were the two experts in the evidentiary hearing trying to eventually get the source code, which we failed in other regards as well and the outcomes, but we're here. So this is a good thing. And to remind folks, so mainly I just want to talk about the context to remind y'all what was up here. So this is 2006. The 13th Congressional District in Florida involved Christine Jennings, the Democrat, who Dan and I were working for at one point, and then Vern Buchanan, the Republican, who ended up being seated and then subsequently elected or reelected, as some people would say. Then the problem was that there were roughly 18,000 undervotes in this election, and through a variety of techniques, it looks like 14,000 of those undervotes were produced somehow by malfunctioning machines. The question is, what's the nature of the malfunction? And the legal question was, of course, well, how would we even find out what the source of the malfunction was? So just to set the context, first of all, to remind us that in this particular election, so this is just a graph of the spending in the 2006, all the House races in 2006. The x-axis is the amount of spending by all the Republican candidates. The y-axis is the amount of spending by all the Democratic candidates. It's a log scale. The red dot up in the corner is the 13th Congressional District of Florida, one of the most expensive and hard-fought House races ever in the history of the United States. It meant, in particular, by the time we got to the recount, is that both sides had a lot of money to try to dredge out every possible vote they could find, and they certainly tried. So the district, this is the district, it involved five counties. The two largest were Manatee and Sarasota, which had over 90% of the population and the voters. Smaller counties around Hardy, DeSoto, and a bit of Charlotte County had smaller percentages. These are the number of, this is the turnout in all these counties in this election and their composition. In the election, about 238,000 votes were cast in the election. This gives you a sense about how close the margins were in all the counties. So the first number in all these boxes is the number of votes given to the Republican Buchanan, the number of votes given to Jennings, the Democrat, and then the margin in favor of Buchanan. You'll notice that in all but one county, there was a net benefit to the Republicans. So it was only in Sarasota where Jennings was running ahead. At the end of the day, 369 votes separated them in terms of the votes that were actually counted in the race. So whenever you're have a race like this and you're trying to win in a recount, the first thing you do is you look to see where the undervotes are, because that's going to be the low-hanging fruit. And this is the undervote rate in all the counties in the district, and the thing that got a lot of people writing on election night. Except for Hardee, which I've never quite understood what was going on there, The other counties had roughly 2% undervote rate in this race, with Sarasota County on net having almost a 13% undervote rate. This didn't look quite right. Began to look at things like the machines. In all of the counties except for Sarasota and Charlotte, they were using optical scans by Diebold. Both Charlotte and Sarasota had ESNS Ivotronics, which will come up later, and I'll say just a little bit about that, but it did provide for a bit of quasi-experimental analysis of the results. This is just a little bit of this is from my deposition to give you a sense about the sort of evidence we presented to the judge to try to convince him that there was something going on here. Here on the x-axis, this is for early voting. On the x-axis is the undervote rate for 27 different races that were on the ballot in Sarasota County. Absentee ballots were, of course, optically scanned. There was no question. There were no questions raised about these ballots, so let's take that as the gold standard. The y-axis was the undervote rate in the DREs in Sarasota County. Pretty good correlation here, except for, our friend, the 13th district. Something looks kind of weird there. Now, it should be remind folks, or to let you know if you didn't obsess about this like we did for a couple of months, that so this is early voting, and in the early voting period, word got out that there was something about the 13th district race that people were having a hard time getting their vote to count. There was a bit of press kerfuffle, and the supervisor of elections went to the press and said, you know, on election day when you come to vote, you got to pay attention to voting in the 13th district because there appear to be problems there. Make sure you pay attention and so that your vote counts. So this is how good that that appeal was. So this is what election day undervoting looked like. So you see a little bit of an effect of the appeal. But nonetheless, a really high undervote rate in the 13th district on election day compared to, again, the undervote rates in all the other ballots. So there were a number of analyses done using a variety of techniques. My technique was a series of regressions that basically were some variant of kind of running regressions like this and trying to figure out, you know, how, you know, what the excess number of undervotes was and kind of backing out some estimates. Mike Herron and Jeff Lewis wrote a declaration working for the ESNS guys, where they did some just simple extrapolations off of proportions. Later, they and some students at Dartmouth wrote a paper using a multiple imputation technique that's used broadly in the social sciences to try to fill in missing values. All of our estimates came up with somewhere in the neighborhood of 14,000 missing votes in this election that just could not be accounted for by anything, by any reasonable voting model that we could pull out of the air. Okay, so there was consensus on the size of the problem. Furthermore, there was consensus that the size of the problem was sufficient that the wrong person was declared the winner. Okay, so in my declaration, taking the size of the number of missing ballots and allocating them to the two candidates, in this case, based on examining the ballot images from the fully counted ballots, we could, for varying sizes of excess undervotes, estimate the size eventually of the Jennings margin. And even if we assume that 80% of the undervotes were due to something like confusion because of ballot design, even if it was only 20% of the problem was because of something to do with the software or the hardware, Jennings wins. So later on, Herron and his colleagues came up with another estimate that pinned it down at about 14,000 votes that Jennings would have won. And by the way, it was kind of a strange experience being in the courthouse in which both the expert witnesses on both sides agreed that the wrong person was declared the winner. And I know probably that my panelists will talk about these, and I won't expend too much time. But one of the issues had to do, so the big issue was what caused the problem. Was it ballot design? Was it stupid candidates? Was it a problem with the candidates that is being too negative? Was it stupid election administrators, and that was ESNS's argument. They threw the supervisor of elections in Sarasota under the bus by saying it was just poor ballot design, or was it bad machines? The ballots, this is the Sarasota County ballot. It's almost like Pong quality computer graphics. But the argument to ballot confusion was, this is the very first ballot screen you got, the congressional races. Catherine Harris, who always seems to show up in election-related problems in Florida, was running for Senate. No end to irony here. But then, so it says congressional, big highlighted, and hidden, tucked over here, is the House race. And then, you know, a big, again, blue state, and then beginning the gubernatorial race. And the argument is that this layout, a lot of people just bounced over this race and didn't notice it. Perfectly reasonable argument. This is in comparison with Charlotte County's ballot, in which you'll notice that we don't have the conflict with the state ballot starting on the second page. It starts on the third page, which, by the way, sets up for the Attorney General to be overlooked. I think we'll probably get some evidence about that. Finally, one piece of evidence that hasn't shown up in print, but since I was here, I thought I would just share it with y'all. I should get this in print because this was introduced actually in the trial. And it did cause the ESNS folks to scramble and gasp for air. So one of the nice things about having, eventually we got the machine logs, and we could figure out the days on which each machine in Sarasota County was calibrated and made ready to vote. And so we could actually plot, the x-axis is the day of the clear and test date for every machine. The y-axis is the percentage of undervotes in all the machines. And as you can see, over time, the closer you got to election day, that machine used tended to produce more overvotes. Okay, a pattern that remains even when you account for the days in which the early voting machines were prepared, which was later in the period. And so now, in fairness, you know, even the best days, it was a 10% undervote rate, shooting up to an average of about 20% undervote rates for the machines that were prepared in the very last days right before the election. So this isn't an argument necessarily that all the undervotes were caused by the machine, but it is at least some plausibility. There's something about the machine, maybe the hardware, that bears some examination.
The size of the circles?
The size of the circles are just proportionate to the number of machines prepared on every day. So these are days with a bunch. See, there's the one out here. So that's what those are. One final note, and I'll turn it over to Walter. So, by and large, the nature of the literature to this point has emphasized this comparison between Charlotte County and Sarasota County, since they both had the same machines, different ballot designs, that has been what has driven a lot of the empirical work. It's unfortunate that we have never gotten the comparison along the other dimension in this table, which is, okay, we've held the machine constant, we vary the ballot design. We've never figured out a way, and the judge told us we couldn't do it, to hold the ballot design constant and vary the machine. And so until we do that, to editorialize a bit, I'm personally happy to accept an argument that at least part of the problem was due to ballot design, but we just simply don't know how to parcel out the effect from the machine from the ballot design problems. So with that, I'll turn it over to...
Okay, next up, Walter Mebbin. There. Just right and left arrow keys.
All right. So I got involved in this way back in the day, especially as working a bit with David Dill. I think we were going to maybe be involved with some kind of a third-party intervention, but we never really got involved in that. But we did a lot of analysis and got into the error codes that were available from the error logs in the machine in Sarasota. So up and down, arrow keys.
Right or left.
Right or left. Okay. So eventually, an activist, and I'm not exactly sure I remember how I got these files, but I got files from several counties beyond Sarasota. But here's an example from Sarasota. So the issue is, as Charles talked about, the issue, one of the issues, came down to whether it was voters being confused by the ballot format, and that was the big argument that was made by Michael Herron and his co-authors, by showing that particular ballot features in three counties were associated with large undervote rates in those counties, Sarasota with the District 13 race and our attorney general's races in two other counties. But that was, if there's a correlation there, the question is that all that's going on? And so others claimed that there were other problems. So at the time, David and I were working together for some reason. I can't remember how we did it. I can't really point. I'll point here. Error message 18, you can see here. Oh, there's a mouse. Okay. So error message 18 invalid vote PEB has two features. One, it has the word invalid in it, so that makes it interesting. But the other is it's also a lot of times it happens, and so you think if you want to try to find some feature that's going to be associated with lots of votes moving, then maybe this count is large enough. So this is the number of machines. These numbers reflect the number of times in the error logs from the county that these errors occur. So it's not 308 machines per se, it's 308 different times on however many machines there were. Okay, but also after the hubbub settled down, an activist pointed out that this low battery lockout message was really interesting because that signified power failures where, for example, machines were plugged into, oops, the plug didn't work, and so once the battery died, the machine died because it was never getting any power. It was also claimed that machines were daisy-chained, one machine plugged into another one, and I'm not exactly sure how this was done physically because I haven't seen the machine. Someone denied loudly that it was possible at one time I talked about this work. But in any case, there was also the issue of if not just one machine is down, but several machines are down. So I take into account this daisy chaining in a way that I'll talk about in a second. So that's possible. Once a machine starts to have power failure, by the time you get the low battery power lockout message, things are really bad. But in the interregnum between the time the power is sufficiently low and the message appears, the machine's operation could have gotten balky. The third thing that came along even later, and I wrote a paper based on those messages of across these several counties that I'll talk about, the power failure and the invalid vote PEB. Okay, the third thing that really is important that came along even later, in my awareness at least, is this terminal screen calibrate message. And this is basically that the screen calibration is apparently screwed up enough to generate this message. So if you touch the screen at one point, you actually might not activate something at that point. Or even more importantly, the time of response of the screen to respond to your touch may be slow. So someone may touch the screen twice, for example, and effectively cancel the vote because by the time the screen responds, they think they've highlighted it, but they've actually canceled their vote at the same time. So all of these messages, and maybe some others too, but you can see this is a subset of the messages, might be associated with the undervote. So here's a display that shows the number of counties that I'm going to look at, and also shows the relative frequency of these error messages that they occur. So here you see in election day and early voting separately, and the counties are Charlotte, Collier, Lake, and so on. Charlotte and I think Lee counties were the ones where the attorney general's race was especially highlighted as due to ballot format. Sarasota is the race where the congressional race was due to the ballot format, it was claimed. And you can see the distribution of error messages. Some of these messages occur very often. Here in Miami, you can see 72.3% or 73% of the machines had this terminal screen calibrate message on it. So that's a pretty high number. Miami also has the feature that it's not shown here, but all the machines apparently, or many of them, were turned on the day before the election, on election day. And I just was shocked to see this, but they're left overnight in the gym, I guess, humming away. And I don't have the early voting data from Miami County. So there's a lot of variation here. And so the issue of, I want to do some statistical analysis and just look at the association between these error messages and the undervote rate. So I have the ballot image data, or whatever it's called in this particular case, and I check to see whether the occurrence of these machine errors is associated with the undervote rate. The E36L message is the one place where I've done a little bit more work, because I tried to identify this daisy chaining phenomena, and I don't actually have any information about what machines were plugged in with other machines and so on. So the best I could do was try to recover that by trying to figure out which machines were kind of close together. So I used information about the PEBs, the personalized electronic ballots, and if machines had the same PEBs used on them, then I counted them as in the same PEB cluster. I think I call it PEB class on this slide. And so those machines are treated, if any machine in that kind of cluster has this power failure message, then E36L is true for all of those machines. Okay, so if you just pool all of the counties, then you get this kind of a pattern. And this basically is using the non-cluster power failure message, a message that showed up. And essentially, it's the three-way table with undervote proportions as the outcome variable. And if you look across every pair of columns, for example, almost every pair, I should say, so look at Commissioner of Agriculture as the office here. These are all the statewide offices that appeared, as well as the House race, whatever House race was in each particular place. So, for example, you see if you go from having no invalid messages to having invalid messages, you increase the undervote rate. If you go from having no power failure to having power failure, you increase the undervote rate. If you go from having no terminal screen calibrate over to having terminal screen calibrate, you increase the power rate. So virtually all of those kind of comparisons in this table, there are one or two that don't go that way, show increases in the invalid vote rate, and this is pooling over all the counties. The numbers are pretty small, so on average it's maybe 2-3% at most, but still, it's a pretty significant association. Here's the same table done with the PEB classes analyzed instead of the individual PEB machines, and some of the magnitudes are a little bit bigger, some of them are smaller, but it seems that it doesn't annihilate them, so there's something to this daisy chaining idea that maybe this PEB classification is getting at. So then what I did most recently is to, and I literally did this last week or something like that, is just to try to tease out all of these different complexities. So I have a menu of these variables, the three I've focused on, the power failure, the terminal screen calibrating, invalid vote PEB, and I have early voting and I have election day. And I spent a lot of time looking at Sarasota in the day and more recently, but the other counties haven't been looked at, that by me at least, that much. But it's possible that early voting and election day are different. For example, you heard about the warning that the election official supposedly issued in Sarasota, telling people to be more vigilant. Okay, so maybe the election day pattern reflects different behavior by the voters, and that certainly shows up. Another thing happens is you might imagine, what's the reaction to, say, a terminal screen calibrate or a power failure? Well, maybe they plug the machines into a working outlet, for example, which may cure the machine's behavior a little bit, or they fix the screen so it's actually calibrated so the behavior is better. So it's kind of unclear whether you'll find increases or decreases because it depends on the behavior of the voters and the poll workers and others in response to these messages, and that could be variable. So there'll be more variation across the counties than really the pool analysis that I showed before. So these are the three offices with Sarasota in the House race and Charlotte and Lee counties with the Attorney General's race. And what I've done is basically filter the variables or do a crude kind of variable selection by using the AIC statistic and keeping all of the things that are significant predictors according to that filter, and then just plotted the predicted probabilities from a logit regression model. So you can see the, for example, here in Sarasota, the vertical bar corresponds to basically the mean in this model is what happens if none of these messages are on, and then you see deviations here. So Sarasota is weird because while the overall rate is high, just over 14% in this particular display with none of the error messages turned on according to the model. The presence of the error messages is associated with lower undervote rates rather than higher. So a power failure is good. What it means to me is that rather than saying the error message or the machine condition predicts these votes according to this basic linear model, weird stuff's going on these machines and you don't really know what's happening. Because it's not as if the undervote is the only problem that's caused by this. It could be that votes are being assigned to the wrong candidate or who knows what's happening, right? So in the attorney general's races, again, you can see that the base rate is pretty high. It's over 20%. But the magnitude, for example, an election day of having power failure is to increase the undervote rate by about 8%, 7 or 8%. Okay. So that seems like a pretty hefty effect. In Lee County, you find magnitudes of effect that are, this is from 15% up to 30. So this is about 8% as well, associated with a power failure and with the invalid VotePad message, as well as with a terminal screen calibrate kind of signal. So while there's a base rate of these undervotes that's pretty high, there's also a span of associations with these error messages that are pretty wide. So I just want to dash through a few more of these just to show the data here, and I've got lots of pictures, but I'll only show a few of them. So you can see some other offices that weren't famous, and the overall base rate of undervotes is not that high. But here, for example, in Charlotte County, there's a large effect for the Commissioner of Agriculture race. All three of these are Commissioner of Agriculture. Here are some other counties, Pasco, Collier, Lake. You can see pretty substantial associations, 2-3%, but still the presence of these associations is more concerning to me than their magnitude. In a sense, you might say there shouldn't be one, and the presence of them may mean who knows what else is going on. My last slide is Sumter Martin, Miami-Dade, and you can see power failures in Miami are associated with about a 3%, 2% increase in the undervotes. So that's it.
Cool. Should I hit this game? All right. So next up, Doug Jones.
So I did hear one significant question, and that is, what does this recalibrate message mean? You get the recalibrate message on an iVotronic when the poll worker intervenes in response typically to voter complaints and fixes the calibration problem. That's the point at which that message occurs. And that means probably some voters before that were working with a badly calibrated machine. You've heard this thing that we had complaints even before the polls opened. There was a Sarasota Herald Tribune report. The undervote rate was about 1 in 6 on the touchscreen machines. And the Florida Department of State commissioned a big report out of the what was the name of that lab, the university?
The
SAIT report. And it basically said, well, there's no evidence that the result didn't reflect the actual votes cast, but there is a need for an in-depth study in the area of effective ballot design. So it was basically, this result is valid. Here's a typical problem report. This is, in fact, the first problem report I received from the 13th Congressional District in Florida. I received it on November 3, well before the election. I had a report from a friend that her vote for Christine Jennings was not present in her review of her ballot choices. She had hit the machine at least 2 times before it finally registered her correct choice. 2 days later, a second person reported that in reviewing her ballot, she learned that her choice for Christine also for the Democratic candidate for Attorney General had been disappeared from her initial selection. This complaint clearly shows the voter blaming it on the machine and describing the problem as one of the machine ate my vote. And it's interesting that it's very hard to find any evidence for the machines actually eating votes. But Ted Selker at MIT in February 2008 released a delightful quick report on a very quick and dirty experiment he'd done where he found that when he used the Sarasota ballot layout on random people walking through some public place in Boston, 16.7% missed the race in question, and that the reason was largely ballot layout. He did discover that if you had a paper script in your hand showing who you intended to vote for, you were likely not to make the same mistakes. So you could fix this with this one procedural thing. In May 2008, Sarah Everett at Rice did a wonderful study in which she showed that over 60% of voters don't notice if their votes are shown on the review screen differently from the way they were selected. She was changing random races on the review screen. But it's interesting to note that if 60% don't notice, multiply that by the 16% who make the mistake and assume that those who do notice it correct their error, you get about 10% undervote rate. But the actual rate on DRE machines in Sarasota was closer to 16%. So what is it about Sarah Everett's work which isn't helping? Why are voters not going back and fixing things? You've seen this before. Selker was noting both that the headline across the top saying state was a problem and that the juxtaposition of a little race with a big race was a problem. So those were his two observations. ESNS had told Florida jurisdictions before the election that some of your machines may have a slow response to the touchscreen. This is due to a smoothing filter in our firmware revision 8.x and higher. So that leaves us with a group of hypotheses if we exclude hypotheses outside the voting booth. And the hypotheses are some kind of banner blindness, the phenomena that people ignore stuff above the banner. If you look at newspapers, you never pay attention to the 101 recipes for pickles above the headline. The news is below that headline. Touchscreen insensitivity, because we have this memo from ESNS saying it was a problem. The possibility of calibration difficulty, which has frequently been attributed to what people call vote flipping, and also actual vote flipping by software. So we at Iowa hypothesized that if we had logged the right events in the event log of the machine, we could have done a better job of diagnosing this. We hypothesized that there should be, that if we logged navigation back from the summary screen to change a race on the ballot, that there should be a lot of those involved with banner blindness kinds of problems. Insensitivity, we can log how long people leave their finger on a button and use that as a measure of the force they're applying to that button and retrospectively diagnose insensitivity. For miscalibration, we figured we could log the relative location of the touch within buttons in order to figure out where people were touching. And if we knew what the normal place people touched was, we could figure out whether they were sliding out of calibration. And of course, navigation back from the review screen to races should go up if people catch the machine actually changing their votes. So we built a machine and we published this result last year at EVT. Andrea Masher-Polkotten and I built a machine that administered a ballot and allowed us to manipulate things like response time, which created an insensitivity situation, allowed us to manipulate ballot design, allowed us to manipulate calibration, and allowed us to actually flip votes to see how people respond. We ran 100 subjects on this. This is a graph from last year. This is navigation back from the summary screen, the number of navigation events during the casting of the ballot. It goes way up when the machine is dishonest. And so if people catch the machine making a change to their vote, and we made it change McCain and Obama because that was a real easy one, people noticed. 60% of the voters noticed the change. It turns out changing the top of the ballot race is really much more easily noticed than mid-ballot races. But when they see one change, they make lots of checking. They go back to all their races in some cases. This one voter went back to 33 races. the average voter goes back to at least two races after seeing one change. So it's very clear that we can detect that. If the response is immediate on a touch screen, voters tap the screen. The cognitive decision to release the finger from the screen comes before the response. It's a tap. You're letting your finger bounce off the screen. And if the screen is insensitive, you push until you see feedback, and then you release. And it appears that that's a very different dynamic, and so that if we did a delay of 100 milliseconds on response, many people were still tapping. But if we delayed 250 milliseconds, suddenly people were pushing from between 300 and 700 milliseconds. So that once the delay crosses this threshold of noticing that you're not getting a response, people start really pushing. In fact, people were complaining that their fingers were getting sore. So we can detect this. We know where people touch the screen. It's easy to measure this kind of thing. It turns out that on our buttons, which were 18.4 millimeters high, which was 90 pixels on the machine we used, the average voter was pressing the screen about 33 pixels up from the bottom. About a third of the way up from the bottom of the machine of the button is the normal place people push, and it's a beautiful normal distribution. And that normal distribution tracks with miscalibration very well until the center of the distribution slides off the button. And since the normal place people touch is low on the button, downward miscalibration, the average touch position starts trailing off when a lot of touches miss the button entirely. Another thing that happens is that when there's miscalibration, people miss the button. And specifically, downward miscalibration causes people to miss the button more easily. And so tracking the number of background touches, the downward miscalibration, the far side there, they suddenly, you get this huge number of people hitting non-active parts of the screen with their fingers. And so we can detect miscalibration that way. It's interesting to look at undervote rates. The number of contest selections is what we counted here. We had a ballot. It was a general election ballot from Johnson County, Iowa, we used. How much? Okay. It was a Johnson County, Iowa ballot, and the number of contest selections was around 32 that you could make. And it turns out a lot of people undervote a lot. We knew that. But the undervote rate really is influenced by difficulty. The miscalibrated machines and the ones with the delay had a distinctly lower undervote rate, particularly the miscalibrated machines. It causes people to undervote. And curiously, compressing the ballot, that is putting multiple races on a ballot, decreases the undervote rate. People vote more. And I think it's because if you put one, particularly in the judicial retention races, if you put one race per screen, people just start banging on the advanced screen rate button to get through it, whereas if you have a bunch of races on the screen, they'll actually vote in them. So the new result, all we needed to log was navigation count per voting session, the rate at which people miss buttons in a voting session, and the average position within button that people touch in a voting session. Had we logged that on a per ballot cast basis, we could have done it. And we have a nice decision tree. If the average navigation miss rate is more than 15% the navigation count, the minimum navigation count, it's probably miscalibrated. If people are touching buttons above center, it's probably miscalibrated. If the average navigation count is really near the minimum, people are doing no extra work, it's likely it's insensitive because people stop doing anything beyond the bare minimum if it's insensitive. And if the average navigation count is way high, more than 1.3 times the minimum, people are really suspicious. They're going back, they saw a surprise, and they're looking at the summary screen. We should have recorded this. So in conclusion, voter problem reports can be really misleading. People report vote flipping as sort of a generic for all kinds of problems. The ballot design probably really did cause a big piece of the 13th Congressional District problem. Touchscreen insensitivity probably made people not go back from the review screen and fix things. Their fingers were sore, they wanted to get out of there. And we can log enough to diagnose such problems.
All right, so last up, Kristen Green.
Doug is quite a bit taller than I am. Can you guys hear me back there? All right. I think Dan saved me for last because he knew I could speak quickly and try to make up a little bit of time. So I think we should still have time for plenty of questions at the end. So I hope in the next 7 minutes to answer this question, can laboratory studies help explain what happened in Sarasota? I think the answer is an emphatic yes. This was research that was part of my doctoral dissertation at Rice University. However, I'm currently now at NIST.
Experiencing technical difficulties there.
Okay. All righty. So first let me special thanks to NSF and Accurate for funding the work, and of course my advisor, Mike Byrne, committee members, Dan Wallach, Phil Cordham, David Lane, and of course my old lab mates at Rice. So you've heard several different explanations already, so I'm not going to go through these in great detail. Malicious software, as you already heard, they couldn't get their hands on the ESNS code. So touchscreen miscalibration, insensitivity, seems likely problem. Voter apathy. As you heard, a lot of money spent on this campaign, so very unlikely that this was a cause of undervotes. Poor ballot design. That is definitely what I'll be focusing on. We know that ballot design has affected voter behavior in previous elections and in laboratory research. In previous studies, we found that just simply changing navigation style can have drastic effects on voting system usability. So this really seemed like it must have been likely to have played a problem. I will gloss through these, because what I really want to focus on is one of the three different human factors hypotheses. As you heard mentioned before, is banner blindness. Also, inconsistent highlighting. So you can see that congressional is highlighted in blue there. I'm not going to be talking about that. We did look at it. Wasn't an effect. What I am going to be focusing on is inconsistent screen layout. So on the first screen that voters in Sarasota County saw was one single race. As you can see, it's pretty much centered there, takes up the bulk of the screen. Second screen, they saw not one, but two races. You've already heard how uneven that distribution of screen real estate was. So we really wanted to, in a laboratory study, collect some hard data to assess the validity of this claim that poor ballot design at least partially explains the Sarasota election results. We needed to empirically determine whether voters unintentionally skipped the U.S. representative race. And this is a real crucial, crucial benefit of laboratory studies. We can know voter intent. Unfortunately, in the interest of my 7 minutes, I do not have time to go into great detail on our methodology. We use the same basic methods that we've used in our previously published work. Had a mock election, recruited representative voters from the Houston area, so wide range of age, income, education, voting experience, everything you'd think might matter. We had subjects vote on a DRE that mirrored the look of Sarasota's. I'll show you some screenshots shortly. And what's really important here is that we manipulated the number of races they saw on that first screen. So we changed the ballot's design. So you might think at first glance that this was the Sarasota ballot. No. If you notice, the names are different. These are fictional names. So this was what half of participants in my study saw. So half of all participants saw only a single race on their first screen. The other half of participants saw two races on the first screen, and that's really important because what we want to know is whether the number of races they saw on the first screen, so that ballot design, influences or predicts undervoting in that critical U.S. representative race. Make sense? Nods? Yes. And indeed it did. Not only that, but it was the only significant predictor of whether people initially skipped that critical race. It was the number of races they saw on the first screen. 19 out of 63 voters, or 30%, who saw a single race on the first screen initially skipped the critical race. Only 8 of 74 voters, or 11%, who saw two races on their first screen did so. Now, those are rates for initial skipping only, because many, in fact, most, 20 out of 27 voters, went back and later corrected the error. So this raises a really important question. Why did our subjects correct when Sarasota voters did not? This is most likely related to the cost of correction. We know that user actions are highly sensitive to small local costs. You've already heard plenty about how insensitive or delayed reaction time, response time, that the Sarasota DREs were. So in Sarasota, there was a cost associated with navigating back to change your vote. There was no such cost in our systems. We didn't have a delay. Didn't have that problem. So I think that I'm doing all right on time here. Discussion?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Oh, well, then I can talk about something I wasn't planning to talk about, but somebody else alluded to. So we finally have data that directly addressed the question of whether poor ballot design affected Sarasota election results. In the Jennings and versus Buchanan court case, you know, the litigation lasted, what, nearly 15 months? They couldn't actually really examine this. You need data. And we think we finally have some. We did find that inconsistent ballot layout increased undervotes. There was no evidence for other factors, e.g. highlighting, had an effect. Really think that laboratory studies complement field research. Neither one of them should exist in a vacuum. We really need both to tell the whole story of what happened in Sarasota. So I wasn't going to talk about it, but since somebody else mentioned Charlotte County, that was actually a separate study that we did and also found problems, effects of poor ballot design there as well. So had to sneak that in at the end. That's it.
All right, well, we're going to throw it open now for discussion and questions. We have microphones. Please announce your name and affiliation or rock band affiliation. And
Duncan Buell, University of South Carolina. Question to anybody, possibly answered by Kristen. I have heard one theory that says that if you force people to acknowledge that they have not voted for all of the possible contests they could vote for, they will go back and hit the first button they can find. Yes, no, likely, unlikely?
On?
Yes.
Yes. Well, it's funny you should mention that. Someone else at Rice University has actually been looking at the effects. of requiring voters to actually acknowledge that they're intentionally undervoting. Was that what you were getting at?
Yes.
Not quite published yet, but on its way. So I might have to field that question.
I'm David Dill from Stanford University. I spent a lot of time looking at ballots. In fact, I was working on a paper with Dan Wallach about how it wasn't user interface design. And then there were, I think, six different statewide races or six races in Florida that had really bad undervotes, some significantly worse. Unfortunately, I've forgotten all the details, but the ballot layout design problems to explain all of those were a little different from the summaries we've heard here. I think that it was something like if you had more than one race on a screen and one of them had only two candidates, that was likely to be undervoted. And that like consistently explained every one of these things. And the reason I decided not to write this paper is that I realized that I had collected all these sample ballots from various people, and in fact, it wasn't following that pattern. And I realized I had my file names wrong, and that I had misunderstood, and that in fact it was a perfect predictor of high undervote rates for that. Does anybody else know about this, or did you test any other ballot layouts besides the really short on top of the really long?
Still on? Yeah, so we actually didn't just have the first two mimic the first two screens of the Sarasota ballot. We actually did do all of the ones through, I think, the Charter Review Board, District 6 or something like that. So we did get, I think you're referring to the subsequent pages where there's three races all packed onto a single screen.
Typically,
yeah, didn't find any real significant effects there. That wasn't really something that I was had specifically looked for in the data, so I think actually it might be worth going back and doing some reanalysis there.
Steve Wolfman, University of British Columbia. I had a question, I think, for Walter Maybank.
Is it possible that there was some correlation between, say, when the machines were set up, the graph that you showed? I am asking the right person, right? No, sorry, Charles Stewart. I'm sorry. The graph that you showed with the increasing date, and also separately, the error log, where errors occurred, with locations within the district, so that maybe there would also be correlation with demographic differences across the district that could separately explain undervote rates.
Yeah, I mean we did a lot of analysis in a large number of different ways to try to explain the undervote rate, including the demographic analysis. Which was actually really important in terms of the court case, because if we could show that race was a factor, we might have a stronger claim than other demographics. And we could not show we could not show the power of any demographics in the undervote rate, thing number one, nor could we show, say, a relationship between demographics and the distribution of where the machines went. And in fact, to a large degree, one of the nice things from the inference side is it looked like the machines were kind of randomly distributed throughout the county. So it was the case that if you were to look at the individual ballot images, it kind of did matter at an individual level the day on which your machine was prepared, whether you undervoted or not. So it wasn't just the aggregate thing. What I wish I had known about was the other analysis that looked at the individual machine codes, because we might have been able to drill down even further.
Can I just chime in on that? Laboratory data also support that, because when I said that number of races on screen one was the only significant predictor of whether people undervoted on screen two, I meant it. So we actually did a logistic regression that did include education, age, and number of races on screen one, and highlighting, and the only significant predictor was that layout.
So. I'll underline that too, because we did the same check against our experimental subjects and came up with no demographic predictors on any of the behavior.
My name is Jim Soper from the Voting Rights Task Force. I went to the Sarasota County website and saw that the iVotronic had a undervote warning capability, so that when you got done voting and you had undervoted, it would say, hey, you didn't undervote here. Was that turned on or off in Sarasota?
It was on.
It was on? Thank you.
So what happened is your summary screen that summarized all your selections would have the races in which you'd made no choice would be highlighted. And that was included in our experiment, too.
So I David Jefferson from Verified Voting. I have stared at the first two screens of the Sarasota ballot for a long time myself, and I had kind of an alternate hypothesis that doesn't conflict with what you said. It's just a different way of explaining the same data, perhaps, and I wanted to see if you commented on it. When you look at that first screen, there are about four different kinds of horizontal dividers on it. The big banner between federal, state, and local, the divider between the races, the divider between the candidates, and then there's the page divider. And it seems to me, when you look at, and a voter comes to these machines maybe once every 2 years, and they've probably forgotten everything they ever saw about it, if they ever saw it before. So they basically have to relearn it, and when do they learn it? They learn it when they see that first screen. By the time they got to the 10th or 20th screen, and this was a very long ballot, they probably got it down. But with the very first screen, my hypothesis was that, especially if they're more visually oriented and less text oriented, they may misparse or misguess, misabsorb what the dividers mean. And we come to that second page that they have made a cognitive hypothesis about what the dividers mean, and they've made it incorrectly. And that race in the top of the second page looks casually like a continuation of the race on the first page. Anyway, it's not in conflict, but what do you think about this learning process that voters have to go through when they encounter the voting machine for the first time in 2 years?
think that's a great point. In fact, that explains exactly why people in this study, when they saw two races on the first screen, were less likely to undervote in that U.S. representative race. Because as you said, they learned, they see on the first screen where and what those dividers mean. And I don't know if it'd be helpful to put that back up or not, but I think you're exactly right. And I don't think they conflict our results at all. It's a great point.
Hi, Theron G from UC Berkeley. So I just like to clarify, I heard you mention that highlighting didn't actually play an important part in the election. So in your first example, when you altered the ballot, I believe you had two elections on the first screen, but both of them were highlighted, versus the real election on the second screen, which that's not highlighted. So it seems to me like, so at least when my first thought, when I thought saw this screen, I thought that the highlighting played an important part in recognizing that. So I wonder if you made a separate experiment that tested that.
Exactly, and in the interest of time, since Dan would only give us 7 minutes each, I didn't get to. I didn't get to explain that that was actually a separate manipulation. So those screens, I actually removed all the highlighting entirely. So that was a totally different independent variable. So they could either see no highlighting or highlighting one race or two races on the first screen. So it was actually quite a bit more complex of an experiment than what I was able to describe here. But we did find that highlighting had the presence or absence of that highlighting had no effect on predicting undervotes.
Sharon Laskowski from NIST. So we've talked somewhat about laboratory studies. I wonder if any of you might hypothesize about where else laboratory studies might be useful in the voting arena, because we don't see very many of them.
I would have liked to have seen a laboratory study of the operation of the machines under real conditions, like actually seeing what happens in the conditions of power failure.
Yeah. Poll workers as test subjects.
Actually, in the case of the iVotronic, the first deployment of the iVotronic in Miami-Dade County, they did an event log analysis after the fact and found that 10% of the machines hadn't been plugged in. And this appears to be something like normal. And this became such an issue that they did ask ESNS, and they did actually sit down in the Miami-Dade County election office and leave a machine unplugged while voting on it all day to see what happened. It turned out the screen faded to illegibility before the machine couldn't operate properly, which was a useful thing because people would definitely stop voting if they couldn't see the image.
And in a more general sense, I think laboratory studies are very useful to develop protocols and test methods and performance metrics that we can use to evaluate systems. I mean, you can't compare system A to system B if you're using totally different methods and totally different metrics. So I think they're useful in that sense.
David Dilligan is coming back to me. So one of the salient facts about this, particularly when you said that the only predictor was ballot layout. In fact, if you look at the Sarasota statistics, and everybody who looked at the ballot images, I think, knows this because it's the first thing that came out, is that whether the voter voted for lots of other Democratic candidates or lots of other Republican candidates was probably the single best predictor of whether there was an undervote in the CD13 race. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's, I think, what happened. Now, I assume that, I don't know. Did other people notice this? Did it come out in the laboratory testing that party affiliation somehow affected this, or was there some other variable? Has anybody explained that phenomenon?
Well, I can agree about the correlation since we wrote that paper together in Sarasota. I've actually looked at a few of the other counties, and there's weird partisan correlations. I'd say it's a crazy quilt of correlations.
So since we were using fictitious candidates, I did not actually put in a political affiliation when I was doing the logistic regression, since we weren't sure that the candidate names weren't particularly meaningful in and of themselves. Now, I definitely think that now that you've mentioned it, it's a great idea. I'll go back and redo that and see if that explained anything in my study.
And for our experiment, the one thing we didn't record coming out of the people's interaction with the machine was how they voted. It simplified immensely questions of privacy for human subjects.
Ana Maria Quevedo, undergraduate student at Miami-Dade College. I would like to ask if there was any study conducted on the Miami-Dade ballot that had a different graphical design. I saw some issues with the undervote. If there has been any study other than the text ballot that the rest of the counties in Florida were using.
The thing to note is the SNS made that really lousy ballot design obsolete even before that election in Sarasota, and came out with a much prettier ballot design that was based on pre-rendering and had a very nice graphic appearance. Our study was actually done on a ballot that was sort of halfway in between in its prettiness. We didn't try to replicate this abysmal-looking design, we got a similar rate of undervoting on it. For the case where we manipulated things, we didn't see differences caused by prettier design, except people didn't complain about the design, whereas this, people complain about it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Because we're actually at the break time, which is kind of amazing. All right, let's thank our panelists very much.